you know, when the wind doesn't blow or the turbine is broken, you know, what do we have to do? So we have to go out and replace that power that we thought we were going to buy from that wind turbine.
Because you've sold it on to someone else, right? And so you've got to buy it back from the market, not a 40 quid at whatever it is now.
But that's where flexibility can come in, by contracting things like batteries, peaking plants. You can manage those price periods. At the end of the day, each electron that's in your, that comes out of the wires in your home or your office, is indistinguishable to another electron, right? You know, how granular do you want to go? And that's something that, you know, Smartest Energy have been pushing for quite actively. Is, you know, certificates are already issued monthly. Why are we not matching on a monthly basis?
As we get further down a rabbit hole here, we're going to see the reasons why it is the market that it is. But the decision's been made. Who makes that decision?
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another installment of the Modo Select series, where we revisit some of our earlier episodes. This Modo Select is with Vishnu Agarwal, Deputy VP of Origination and Renewables at Smartest Energy. If you're enjoying the podcast, please like and subscribe. It really means the world to us. Let's jump in.
Vishnu Agarwal, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thanks very much for inviting me.
This is a world first. We've got the first person who's come on the podcast who's brought graph paper with them, which is very impressive. So we can tell that you're a trader and you do lots of maths and lines.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming up. And you're in the Birmingham office today and you're based in London, right?
Yeah, I'm based in London. I'm originally from Birmingham, so it worked out really well coming down today.
We just found out that we went to rival schools, right? So we may have even seen each other in sports fields at some point in the past. Yeah. So do you want to tell us kind of what you do and what the company you work at does?
Sure. So I'm Vishnu. I look after the renewables trading and origination teams at Smartest. And Smartest Energy is a supplier trader. We've been around since 2001, where we started out as a PPA aggregator. So aggregating PPAs of all range of sizes, so from, you know, a single stick turbine in a farmer's field to large kind of offshore wind farms.
PPA being a power purchase agreement, right?
Yeah.
I'll just keep doing this. So it's no, not no. Your, it's not you, it's me.
No worries. So power purchase agreement. So a contract to buy an amount of power for a set duration of time. Under a specified kind of pricing mechanism.
Cool.
Yeah. So Smartest did that for since 2001. So we're celebrating our 20-year history at the moment. And then in 2008, we launched our retail business. So that's supplying mainly businesses, large industrial and commercial businesses, with power and mainly on a flexible basis as well. So that's, you know, B2B business. Customers there. We also, we're kind of behind a lot of other suppliers that you may see in the market. So we provide market access services to them to enable them to access the markets.
Can you say who? Or give us like an example?
Yeah, sure. So one company, for example, is publicly traded. So I can talk about them. So that's U Energy Group.
Okay.
So they're in the SME space. So they supply small and medium-sized businesses, and they've been with us for a number of years, and they've grown substantially at the moment. And, you know, particularly in markets like this, where commodity prices are so volatile, and the markets are so illiquid, you know, it's really important to have a trading partner that can support you in efficiently hedging what you need to do as you sell contracts.
Okay, cool. And so Smartest Energy, lots of energy and money flowing through Smartest Energy in and out all the time.
Yeah.
How do you describe your job there? Can we call you a trader? Or do you do more or less than that or different to that? And which bit do you specialize in?
Yeah, sure. So I sit within the trading team, and the trading team basically takes on risk from any contract that Smartest sells. So within any contract, there's different types of risk, and the primary risks are kind of price and volume, two types of risk. And we sit managing that. So from those contracts, there may be risk in, you know, the renewable certificates, there may be risk in the power, the gas, and you know, I sit within that to manage that and look after the teams that manage that and put in place the contracts. There's also contractual risk. So, you know, we'd spend a lot of time dealing with legal, making sure that our contracts cover what the customer wanted it to cover. Making sure that the risks they wanted to transfer to us are transferred. So that's really the role of Smartest, is to take on risk from a customer and decide where that boundary is between the customer and Smartest.
Can we talk basics for a second, right? So how does a PPA work? How does a power purchase agreement work? So let's say we build a wind turbine, one wind turbine on a windy hill in Birmingham, right? And then we come to Smartest and say, right, we're going to create some power and we need someone to buy it.
Yeah.
And then what happens?
Yeah, so we talk to the customer and say, look, how do you want us to buy it? You know, do you want to buy us, firstly, tenor? Right? Do you want us to buy it for 1 year, 2 years, 10 years, 15? And on what basis? You know,
what's normal there? What's kind of a rule of thumb? Do people generally do 1, 2, 3, 10, 15? What's kind of average?
That's a good question. It's all over. I mean, we have agreements out 15 years. They tend to be projects that require kind of bank funding. But, you know, typically what 2 to 3 years is a typical PPA length.
Okay, cool. And, so I've got my wind turbine and we're going to sign a 3-year deal where the wind's going to blow, I'm going to generate electricity and you at Smartest Energy are going to buy it. And then what else is involved and what other things are you thinking about?
Yeah, so then the customer really has to say, well, are you happy with where market levels are at the moment?
And if so, you mean price?
Price levels, yeah. So if you're happy with the price at the current market, then do you want to lock in that price for that year? So we could propose a fully fixed price, you know, taking all of that volume risk off them. So pay as produced, if you will. So a unit rate for every megawatt hour they produce. Or if they say, well, actually, you know, we're agnostic to that. We want to take an index, for example. They may choose to take the day ahead rate every day throughout that 3 years, 2 or 3 year period. And so it's a question of, you know, how much risk they want to take to the market price, is one, but also to their volume as well. So they may say, you know, Smartest, you take all of the risk of our volume, the production. So we don't know when it's going to be windy, when it's not going to be windy.
Smartest Energy, you've got to guess how much power my wind turbine's going to make based on how windy it is, which you don't know in the future. You've got to figure that out. And then you're going to buy that at a certain price. That's where you and the risk people come in, right?
That's exactly it. I mean, it's a very, very difficult problem to solve. And not only, even if you can guess when it's going to be windy and when it's not going to be windy, there isn't tradable products out there in the market to be able for us to offset that risk, if that makes sense. If you think, I don't know, it's going to be windy, you know, in 3 weeks' time for 1 hour, is there a market to be able to sell that power for that particular hour? There isn't. So that's where the transfer risk comes in. Smartest say, well, you know, we'll be happy to take that risk on at this price.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So I might have got a loan from the bank to build my wind turbine.
Yeah.
And that bank loan might have been conditional on me passing off all of the potential downside of this to you, and then Smartest Energy, you're then taking the risk from me, from the bank, if you like. It's all gone through me to you.
Absolutely.
And then what happens if it goes wrong? So say my wind turbine, I think in this winter it's going to be really windy, and then, I don't know, a blade falls off. And so I can't produce power.
Yeah.
You then have committed to buy that power from me, but I can't produce it. So therefore, how are you going to find that power? Where are you going to make up the difference in what you've committed to the market? How does that work?
Yeah, that's a really good question. That's, you know, that's part and parcel of renewable generation, or any generation, really. You know, there's obviously times where there's maintenance, there's issues with, you know, force majeure issues where the plant breaks. So for us, it's about trying to forecast those periods.
Wow, is a wind turbine breaking force majeure? That's interesting. I guess you could argue if it was like otherworldly windy and blew it over.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's an interesting question.
Well, it could be. It depends on, you know, could be due to war or civil,
civil
unrest, for example, that it fell over. So, just
to be clear, wind turbines don't fall over in general. This is all rather silly, but yes,
they're fairly stable. The main worry we have is when the wind doesn't blow.
Yes,
as we saw in 2021 last year, super historic low levels of wind against kind of rising prices. So that goes back to your question, really, is when the wind doesn't blow or the turbine is broken, what do we have to do? So we have to go out and replace that power that we thought we were going to buy from that wind turbine.
Because you've sold it on to someone else, right?
Because we've already sold it on to a customer or the market at that point. And especially, in times like this where prices are hugely increased from a year ago, if that customer has signed a year ago, then that cost of replacing it, that power for us is huge.
So for example, I might have signed a 3-year deal. So there's lots of background noise. Hopefully everyone's okay with that. So I might have signed a 3-year deal in 2020 to sell power for my wind turbine at a price of, I don't know, £100 a megawatt hour. That's high, isn't it?
That's for 2020, COVID years.
Let's say, £40, right? Yeah. And then 2 years down the line, my wind turbine has had an issue and it can't run. But you've already sold that power. Yeah. And so you've got to buy it back from the market, not £40 at whatever it is now, which is, what is it right
now? So for winter, 200? It's 500 plus. Right, okay. I mean, probably by the time this goes to air, it's going to be out of date, whatever I say, but it's, yeah.
So not only am I out the money, the £40 from my wind turbine, which I'm quite sad about, but you as the counterparty, you've got to find that difference of £400-£500 a megawatt hour.
Yeah.
Right. So your role in this exchange is one of a lot of risk. And so how do you hedge that? How do you manage that risk?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So we hedge that with market available products, for example. So where we can find matching products to what the forecast is, then we'll go out and trade that. We can also utilize shape and things like that we have in the market or through other contracts, so we can manage it as a portfolio effect. But then also flexibility really, really will play a critical role in managing these risks going forward. So historically it's been less so, right? The kind of capture rates, as we call them, for wind and for solar have been relatively benign compared to now. But now with the scale of those capture rates decreasing.
What does that mean? Sorry, what does a capture rate mean?
So assuming a certain amount of energy forecast for the day ahead, how much of that is captured from the day ahead baseload price? So the average price for that day, due to the shape of that production, how much of that is actually captured? So for example, for wind,
Let's use my wind turbine as an example. So day ahead, we think it's going to be, 80% of total windiness.
Yeah,
and therefore we think we can capture. There's going to be a price of something, and then
you sell 80% of that production day ahead, but the hours in which it is windy, the price is depressed, right? Because it may be windy everywhere, so there's a lot of energy on that system. Pushes that price down in that hour, let's say, and that capture rate, the differential between that hour and the average price, for that day is the capture rate.
And what we're aiming to do is capture the baseload price, right? We don't want it to be too windy everywhere, and that'll drop the price, and then we don't capture quite as much.
Exactly. Okay. But that's where flexibility can come in, right? So by contracting things like batteries, peaking plants, you can manage those price periods because when it is super windy, you can then charge your battery, for example, and when it's not windy enough, then you be able to use a peaking plant or a battery to discharge power to the grid that you were short.
Cool.
Yeah.
So I want to talk, I think we've done the trading side. I want to talk about, two things, carbon and certificates, which I know we've never talked about much on the podcast before. And I know you know a lot about, and this is a topic which is actually very controversial when you get deep into it. And I'd imagine that as we get further down a rabbit hole here, we're going to see the reasons why it is the market that it is. But hopefully we can come out the end of it with an idea about how it all fits together. So can you explain, please, what the carbon market is and what this certificate market thing is?
So you have to break it down into two different markets. When you have a carbon market, which is essentially a certificate issued for the amount of carbon that you would have saved having built a particular project. So it's an assessment of the, let's say you look at a forest, for example, it's the amount of carbon that would have been sequestered having developed that particular project. Those units of carbon, so per ton, is an instrument that people can use to offset various types of emissions that they may have. And there's three main scopes of emissions that people look at. So scope one, scope two, scope three. Scope one being emissions used for direct use of energy. So, for example, your direct use of natural gas through the grid. There is scope two, which is your indirect emissions, so maybe from your electricity that you consume. And scope three can be things that are maybe from your supply chain. So you can use carbon to offset maybe your scope three emissions, for example. The other type of certificate is what we call energy attribution certificates, things like the REGO, which you maybe may have heard about. What
was it? Renewable something origination or something? What is it? What's REGO?
Yeah, so it's a renewable energy guarantee of origin.
There you go. Yeah.
So that's...
what is that? So we're going to jump around here, but I think it's natural. So I'm going to ask another question that will hopefully feed in. So what does 100% renewable power mean? Right. So if I go to Smartest Energy and I'm a business that really matters to me, that my electricity use is renewable, and I sign up to 100% renewable power supply contract with you. So you're going to supply me with the electricity and we use it for, I know, the office and the aircon and whatever, and the party.
Yep.
So how, when you say it's, when not you, when the company says, so the supplier says it's 100% renewable, what does that mean?
Yeah, so what that means is your electricity is backed by renewable guarantee of origin certificates. So what is renewable? So this stems from a directive, an EU directive, renewable energy directive, back in 2001, and that's evolved over time. But basically legislating that in order to claim that your supply is renewable, you need to use a guarantee of origin certificate to do so. So how does it work in practice? It's a book and claim system. So each renewable generator, so going back to your wind turbine, for every megawatt hour they produce and put into the grid, they can book that energy as per megawatt hour for one REGO, example. Right?
Okay. So you book now and claim later. Is that how it works?
Well, then the consumer claims.
And then the consumer claims.
So the consumer says, right, I've taken this much energy off the grid, and match that with the guarantee of origin certificates and claims the renewableness of that energy. Because at the end of the day, each electron that comes out of the wires in your home or your office is indistinguishable to another electron, right?
That's the thing, right? So this office, for example, we're on a 100% renewable deal. But when it gets to, I don't know, a very cold Wednesday in December, it can't be 100% renewable because there's gas running. There may, hopefully not coal, but there might be coal running. There might be other stuff running.
Absolutely.
And so does this mean that what my supplier does, I can't remember who our supplier is, but what they do is they supply us with the electricity that's from the open market. And then later they account for it and buy back the carbon or buy back the certificates as if it was 100% renewable. Is that how it works?
Yeah. So, well, not necessarily later. They could be hedging that forward. Okay. But what that means is they're matching it on an annual basis. So that's the current legislation is you match it on, you know, April to March compliance years.
Oh, so across a year. So my electricity, our electricity consumption as an office, across the whole year, you have to recover all of that in megawatt hours or carbonness by buying certificates to cover it. And that means that sometimes we might still be using power from carbons from like emissions-y sources like gas or whatever, but we're going to cover it up. That sounds like it. Yes, that's bad. But we're going to cover our position later.
That's exactly it. And so the certificates themselves are issued on a monthly basis. So that's an aggregate of the renewable energy they've produced on a monthly basis, and then those certificates are used to match the consumption on an annual basis.
So on a physical basis, 100% renewable power isn't really 100% renewable power, right? But if that carbon certificate system really worked properly, you, on the whole, you could recover it and you would still be neutral. That's the idea.
Yeah, so it depends on what granularity you want to look at, right? So, you know, is it 100% renewable on an annual basis? Fine. But, you know, how granular do you want to go? And that's something that, you know, Smartest Energy have been pushing for quite actively, is to, you know, to get to net zero, we need to push that matching to a more granular level. So, you know, we need to move, you know, certificates are already issued monthly. Why are we not matching on a monthly basis? You know?
Matching on a monthly basis, right. Rather than
rather than on annual. And then the government needs to move to issue these certificates on a more granular basis. So we can go all the way down to hourly, half hourly matching at some point, but the instrument needs to evolve to allow us to do that.
So there's two questions coming up. The first one we're going to talk about, I want to ask you who issues these certificates, these instruments for carbon, and how does all that work? And then the second bit I want to ask you, which is a two-sided question, what is really good about this system and what is not so good? So there's a lot coming, to pre-warn you. You can put all that in your RAM.
Yeah.
So firstly, who issues these certificates and who decides the rules?
Yeah, so the original rules were from the EU, in Europe anyway. Mm-hmm. So it's not just confined to Europe, but the original rules in Europe were developed in 2001. And what that said was each member state of the EU has to set up an issuing body. That's a body that's responsible for verifying the energy that somebody wants to issue REGOs, or guarantees of origin, as they're called in Europe, against. And then they're responsible for issuing those, and then they are available to be bought and sold from that point. Now, that's in Europe. You know, similar schemes are available internationally. Mm-hmm. There's bodies like the International IREC Association that, where a country has not mandated an issuing body, they'll go and step into that country, set up robust processes and procedures to issue these certificates. And then as soon as that country then becomes a bit more developed and decides to establish an issuing body, they'll step out of that country, but providing an advisory capacity to that government should they wish to. So that's how the certificates are kind of issued.
So there's a central entity that issues these certificates. Yeah. Are they a physical certificate? Do you get a piece of paper? I get a piece of paper in the post and I've got this shiny thing and I can go and trade it with someone else?
They're digital. So they're like a digital certificate. They used to be on paper. I remember, almost 9 years ago, trading Irish certificates that were on physical pieces of paper. That was a lot of postage. They're all digital now.
Okay, cool. And so what's the unit of a certificate, of a REGO? Is one unit one ton of carbon? And how do we make sure that the certificate really does mean that? So what? Because there must be nuances. We're going to get into the details now. There must be nuances about how these certificates are issued and who gets them and all that stuff. So let's talk about that. What's a unit for a certificate?
Yeah. So energy attribution certificates are quite different from the carbon certificates, and the unit of measurement is per megawatt hour.
Per megawatt hour.
So what that's saying is, you know, 1 megawatt hour of wind or solar has been injected into the grid, and that's the beauty of these certificates. They describe exactly what has gone in, mm-hmm. so where it's come from. So that allows consumers to then choose, right? So, you know, we're sitting here in Birmingham and you're saying, well, you know, I'd really like to be powered by, for example, wind from that hill,
mm-hmm.
you know, so you can go out and specify to your supplier, I'd really like to be supplied by that wind turbine. And you know exactly what you're getting because you've bought the certificates from that wind turbine.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Makes sense. And so, I get it on the wind turbine, like the generation side. So I've got my wind turbine, I get my certificates, and then someone else buys them from me.
Yeah.
What about on the other side? So what about big industry? What's their role in this? So say I'm a big steel manufacturer, or I'm around the corner from here, Jaguar Land Rover, for example, uses loads of power for a very good reason to produce cars, but they still use a load of power.
Hmm.
So how do they have to buy those certificates from me? You know, how does all that work?
Yeah. So typically, many of our customers are large industrial and commercial customers, like you mentioned. So what they would do is come to us as a supplier and say, look, I want a renewable tariff. And then they would specify what type of renewable they'd like. So, you know, would they like to be sourced from wind, solar, hydro? They like more base load assets. They like location specific, technology specific, assets, newer assets, things that have been built in the last 5 years, for example. And they can make those requirements known, and that then influences the supplier on their procurement activity, and influences, their purchasing strategy and projects that they then go and buy going forward. So what they're doing is really making quite a powerful decision for their consumers. They're saying, well, our consumers really value the fact that we're producing this good using 100% renewable electricity, and they're then stimulating that market by participating in that market, driving demand for it, and therefore price as well, which then goes on to the developer of those projects.
And so here comes the difficult question, the double-sided. So what's really good about this market? What does the market get right?
Yeah.
What are the hot potatoes that we need to improve on here?
Yeah, definitely. I think, so what's really good is it's a market-based mechanism, and that lends itself to, the examples you just mentioned. So they can play an active part in deciding, they want renewable consumption. So it's about democratizing energy, firstly, and that's what it lends itself to do, and stimulate the market. So it also means that, in a traditional subsidy mechanism world, where the subsidies are borne by the taxpayer or kind of smeared across all consumers, then those who want to play an active part in a low carbon future can take some of that, the cost away from the taxpayer or other consumers. So it works really well in that scenario. Where it could be improved, for sure, it could really be improved in the granularity. It could be improved by legislation to move to, say, what we call full disclosure. So what we'd like to see is every single megawatt hour that you consume is accounted for. So currently, only the renewable energy part carries a certificate. Why does the coal or the nuclear not? So why do you not have to also procure those certificates as well? And so that will really drive further change, and also, allow consumers to dictate what the future grid mix looks like.
So rather than an ego, where every bit of generation has a number and a certificate, which says how much carbon you produce for that.
Well, like a guarantee of origin, like they have in Europe. So it's called guarantee of origin because they issue them for nuclear, they issue them for other things.
Is this market doing? Here comes the simple question. I think this market is supposed to help us get to net zero. And does this market help us get to net zero?
So this market allows us to make those claims that we want to make. And it's a voluntary, completely voluntary market. Now, is there legislation that could help us move quicker to net zero? Absolutely. So the future renewable energy directives, for example, RED II, in 2018, then looked and said, well, each member state should look to target 32% of all energy coming from renewable sources. Right. So it actually helps put targets on things and then helps account for those targets.
Because you've got a unit of account.
Yeah. And then they went even further, at the moment.
32 is not that high, is it?
It's not. It's not.
When have they got to do that by?
That's 2030.
2030.
But they are.
Come on, guys.
They've got the new Fit for 55 strategy, which improves that to 40%.
Okay.
But it's still,
Fit for 55, but the number's actually 40. 40%. What's the 55? Is that 2055?
I'd imagine so.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
And so, like, these certificates, can I go and buy some certificates? I've got a bit of money in my pocket, just won the lottery. Can I go and buy? I really want some certificates.
Yep, if you find somebody willing to sell you those certificates.
So it's not like is it a regulated market, or can anyone play in this market?
It's not regulated in that sense. Okay. So anybody can play in that market.
So this, because this is, we're talking about the market, right? So generators buy, because I'd imagine it's not just suppliers who take part in this market. Do you have other traders who see, oh, I could buy now, sell later? Because the price is constantly moving around, right? Yep. And so what drives that price?
Yeah, so we find other actors in the market, just as in the power market and the gas market. So there's other liquidity providers and traders. What drives the market? So you've got similar fundamentals to power and gas. So you know, we looked last year, super low levels of wind. More than 40% of all guarantees of origin are issued from wind. So that really pushed prices up as wind was, you know, a lot more scarce. So you have the fundamentals.
I think it wasn't windy enough.
Yeah. So okay, cool. Wind, your turbine on the hill didn't blow quite as much as you'd expected that year. And then on the consumption side, what's demand doing? So that picture's really, really increased, right? So you may have seen by switching your energy at home, the offerings you get aren't, by and large, a lot of them are 100% renewable tariffs.
It all makes sense to me here, right? But the thing, like if you read the newspapers or whatever about REGOs, the argument is the price of REGOs is so different to the price of the actual carbon, if I've got this the right way around. So like for people who produce, if you want to go and buy actual renewable, like the good energy piece, right? Which is like, if you want to buy actual renewable power, doing that costs way more than just getting a certificate for it, because there's more certificates than there's, I don't know. What's the argument about why this market isn't right? What's going on there?
Sure. So we need to get away from, you know, the carbon in it. So that what they are, they're energy attribution certificates. So they show you that 1 megawatt hour has gone into the grid and 1 megawatt hour was taken out of the grid. The pricing is reflective of consumer demand, and that's the way that it's pricing. It's not reflective of the cost of carbon, because obviously in a project, then whoever's developing that project has, you know, the commodity they can sell the power for, they have the subsidy, they have other things within that thing. They're not just selling that certificate. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense. And I think where some of the arguments really fall down is the understanding of our electricity system here in the UK. So our electricity system in the UK is such that you could set up and be a supplier and not have, you know, you don't have to be vertically integrated like you used to have to be. You know, you don't have to have your own generation and supply just your own power to somebody mm-hmm. else. It simply doesn't work, right? You know, we talked about the intermittency issues before. You get to balancing, you need to buy power from somewhere else, right? So the whole concept of saying, well, you can only supply renewable energy from plants that you've bought from doesn't work, right? As a supplier.
Yeah.
So you take an example of, Ørsted, for example, right?
Because you need a secondary market for it.
You need a secondary market. So Ørsted, you know, they're divesting their supply business. Very little supply now in the UK. Huge, one of the largest, you know, renewable producers in the UK.
Yeah.
So in that argument, you'd say, well, what happens to the renewable energy that Ørsted produce? If they sold all of their energy on the exchange day ahead, are we saying that simply doesn't exist anymore? Because they haven't got a supply business to send that on. So this is...
It's complicated, isn't it?
It's really complicated, but fundamentally the consumers can choose how to get their renewable energy. So they could go and sign a corporate PPA, for example. They could sign a PPA. We've already discussed the risks involved, and that's a risky proposition, but they could do that so
Modo, we could go to a wind turbine owner and say, right, we're physically going to buy your power, a bit like what these, like Microsoft and Alphabet and these big data center providers are now doing, aren't they?
Yeah. But then you've also got to get comfortable with the fact that you're not going to be 100% renewable all the time, right? If you're looking, depends on the granularity that you're looking at. But that's not always possible for most people, right? If you're sitting in London, you're living in a one-bed flat, you can't go and feasibly go and sign a corporate PPA. You can't go and put solar panels on
your
rooftop.
Don't tell me I can't. No, we certainly can't. Yeah. So what about this? There's a hot potato at the moment about Europe, right? So there's going to be a decision soon about REGOs, guarantees of origin, about how we trade with the EU. And is this related to Brexit? Is this because of Brexit, or is it okay? What's all that about?
Yeah, it's a good question. So actually, we've had the decision, and that came out on Wednesday. But essentially, in the UK, we were able to import guarantees of origin from Europe. And what that, along with importing the renewable powerness of it, you would also be eligible for an exemption to various schemes. So the subsidy scheme of the small FIT scheme and the larger FIT scheme, the CFD scheme. Now, the reason that came about was because of EU state aid rules. So it was part of the agreement that the UK had to make with the EU. As being part of the EU. So since we left the EU, that's no longer applicable. You don't need to apply these exemptions anymore to European power. So that's always been, since Brexit, a controversial point, because why are we still applying them? So, it's certainly something that we've questioned. And now that decision has come.
So what's the decision that we do?
So the decision is that the EU guarantees of origin are no longer eligible for exemptions in the UK.
So that means that we our market for these certificates is now just a UK market. Not, we can't trade with Europe on this stuff.
Yeah, so there was two decisions made. And the second decision was we'd actually unilaterally not accept any EU guarantees of origin certificates at all.
So we can't cover our carbon. So I'm a steel producer. I can't buy carbon. Well, sorry, stop me. So Smartest Energy, who's my energy supplier, is a steel producer.
Yeah.
Smartest Energy now can't go to a German wind farm and buy the certificates and then offset it over here. Is that how it works?
Yeah, so they can't go out and buy.
They can't anymore.
From them and import them into the UK. And that's
Is that
that's
good? Is this good? Or is this bad?
There's arguments for and against, right? So, for that definitely helps our UK production, incentivizes more development in the UK.
Yeah, good.
Which is good. Bad. We're over the next 5 years, we're expecting to double our interconnection capacity, right?
Yes.
So what, we're importing all this energy from connected countries.
And it gets the interconnection. The carbon certificate can't get through. It's like
so. What color is that energy? Right? Because capacity in 2030. Theoretically, over half of our energy could come from abroad if we were just importing full time.
Like 20 gigs or something like that, isn't it, of interconnectors, maybe more.
Yeah, it's going to double. So what are we saying? Are we saying that that energy is grey or brown? Like, we don't know what colour that energy is.
Tricky.
Right? So, and then that has a knock-on effect for consumers, right? Because if you're a corporate, and you can choose where to domicile yourself, right? You can domicile in Europe, you can domicile in the UK. And if you can't guarantee that you're going to be able to source what you need and have 100% renewable supply, because you want to help the net zero transition globally, then, and you can't guarantee you're going to get it, and you can't guarantee you're going to get it at a suitable price point.
Oh, this is so annoying. Yeah,
why
we need
it's going to affect your decisions, right? Where you're going to set up.
It doesn't make any sense. Because then the interconnector because the interconnector's got a trading team, right? Well, they're going to have to buy like 20 gigs worth of, on both sides across the interconnectors, 20 gigs worth of REGOs and net them off against either side. I mean,
But there's no mechanism, right? That's the point. So that's where there's a bit of a gap. And certainly, we can see from historic consumption of EU and UK certificates, it's huge, right? The demand in the UK
is huge. It's almost as if being related to Europe was a really good thing. It was the first Brexit comment on this whole podcast in 22 podcasts, and I can't believe I did it. Yeah. So, that is complicated. Yeah. But the decision's been made.
Who
makes that decision?
So it's really curious. So that the department that makes the decision is the BEIS. So
yeah,
Business and Energy and Industrial Strategy.
Yeah.
So on one hand, they've obviously they made a decision on energy.
It was our government. Our government made this decision.
Yeah, our government on energy. But then it's the same department that's responsible for business as well. So they're also putting up the price for consumers of renewable energy.
Because the steelworks is going to have to pay more because there's going to be some more scarce supplies of these certificates in the UK, which is going to push energy prices up for big industrial consumers, the same people that they...
So the decision is removed.
Oh, what a mess.
You know, it's removed 30, 40% of supply out of the UK.
The value of a renewable generator has increased, right, in pounds, because we all pay, even though, you know, historically prices at 50 quid for wind, because everyone's now paying 350, the value of that wind is now 350, not 50. So you think that the value of the low carbonness of it is should also increase. But it's complicated. I guess the wider the difference between the percent, the value of the certificate and the power price, it gets to a point where it becomes silly, right? If the certificate was only 0.01% of the power price, it would be silly, I think. And if it was a bigger percentage, it would be a bit more rational.
I think the price just reflects what the demand is at that time
for that certificate.
So it reflects the consumer demand.
Yeah.
For that. So if people aren't willing to, you know, to advocate for renewable energy, then the prices will fall.
Which might happen, right? Because this other number's so big. What? Yeah. How big is the market for these certificates? What are we talking about here?
So in terms of the number of RIGOs issued per year, you're looking at 110 terawatt hours per year.
110 terawatt hours. How does that compare to the overall?
The overall consumption of the UK is about, I think, 270 terawatt hours. So it's about a third.
About a third. So about a third of all the power that we generate has got a RIGO related to it. And then the rest of it, the other two thirds, doesn't have a RIGO related. It doesn't have any ego related to
it. Doesn't have anything, yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah. All right, the next thing I want to talk about is how you do market access. So I know you've done a lot of work as an originator, and the word origination is a word that is kind of bounded around in our industry, but I'd be keen to hear what it is.
Sure, yeah, it's a bit of a catch-all word, really, isn't it? So how we look at origination in Smartest, so we look at anything that's non-standard. So, you know, we've been doing PPAs since 20 years ago. We classify most of them as standard. You know, we're doing supply deals, you know, since 2008, classify those as standard. So anything that doesn't fit into what we call standard products is origination. So something which is more complex and maybe straddles the PPA and supply boundaries. So, you know, corporate PPAs, for example, origination, things with flexibility, things that are a lot more complex, you know, batteries, peaking assets, that kind of thing, as well, and market access. So that's something that, you know, I talked about before, that we provide route to market services for suppliers, for generation portfolios, for other actors in the market.
And so, lastly, we had Peter Vance on recently, and Smartest Energy, of course, is you guys use the Origami Energy System. What other kind of systems do you use to get your job done?
Yeah, so you know, that's a system that we use on the flexibility side, for sure. But we also use quite sophisticated forecasting systems.
Okay,
we use energy trading risk management systems to make sure that we've captured all the risks that we have inherent in all the contracts that we sell.
That's ETRM, isn't it? When people talk about ETRM. Yeah.
That's ETRM systems and other kind of risk reporting metrics as well.
Yeah.
To help us manage and understand our risks as well. Because you can only address those risks once you've understood them.
Do you have to, in the same way that a supplier has to, you need credit cover and you need to post collateral and you have to do all that kind of stuff, which is quite expensive business, isn't it?
Yep.
To prove when you trade on an exchange, I think I'm going to ask you about exchanges in a second, but to prove that you can get a seat at the table. And so do you have to do that in the carbon world too?
It depends on the instrument. So...
The RIGO, the emissions world. I'm going to call it emissions because that's carbon and
Yes, yeah, so the emissions world covers, you know, voluntary carbon and compliance carbon, as well as the REGOs, guarantees of origin certificates as well. So, yeah, for sure. So there's, depending on who you're trading with, you know, if you're trading over the counter, there will be collateral requirements that other party may have and we may have, depending on the credit suitability of each counterparty. And then, of course, if you're trading on exchange as well, then you'll have collateral requirements, initial margin and variation margin that you'll have to post day to day. So similar to the power. But yeah, I mean, talking about, you know, collateral requirements, that's one of the reasons why companies choose to use companies like Smartest for market access, because you're concentrating the collateral requirement to one person.
Yep.
And then you're effectively writing a contract that allows you to get market reflective rates by doing that. And so you really rely on the credit capability of that market access provider to go out and have credit lines with everybody in the market, or as many people in the market, to ensure that your pricing is as efficient as possible.
Right. So where do you trade this stuff? Is it, like, of course, power's on EPEX or yeah. Nord Pool or whatever. Where do you trade REGOs and where do you trade carbon?
Yeah. So similar to power as well. So power is OTC, so over the counter as well. So there's a lot of the market in carbon is OTC and REGOs as well. So in the similar vein to curve power, if that makes sense. So
as in, that's you call up another buyer. It's a kind of a side deal, right? Well, like a bilateral deal between you guys rather than going through an exchange. So with lots and lots of them.
Yes, they can be bilateral, but they can be facilitated by a broker. So
yep.
The brokers would aggregate the interests and do it on a name give up basis. So say, well, okay, you're matched with such and such, and here it is. Go away and sort the contracting out.
Okay, so, cool. Yep. And then I know we're running out of time. I want to ask you about carbon, because we've done a lot of talk about REGOs. Yep. And carbon's in vogue at the moment, isn't it? I mean, the price has jumped in the last year. I think it's dropped quite a bit since then. But what's happening in the carbon markets? What's changed?
Yeah,
it was like, I remember when we first were going to do Brexit, and I think one of the sells from the government about Brexit, we've done it again, but was that we would put a cap on carbon prices of like £16, I think it was, or £12, something like that, back in the day. And at that time, the European carbon market was about 20 or 24. Yeah. And the UK government was saying, okay, to encourage, stimulate growth, we're going to put a cap on the price. And then it got to, what did they get to recently?
So we've been up to 80.
80, yeah. Right. 80 euros.
80 euros.
80 euros. Yeah. So what's going on in carbon? Well, yeah. Because this is wild.
So I think what you're referring to there is compliance carbon. So European allowances, UK, EUAs or UKs. So since Brexit, we've pulled out of the EUA scheme and created our own UK annual allowance.
What does EUA stand for?
UK allowance scheme. So it's carbon allowances, effectively.
Okay.
And yeah, the prices have been absolutely volatile, you know, for various reasons. So what's really pushed up the price is that commitment to net zero and pushing that transition forward. And that's really, really meant that people priced in the value of carbon a lot more. But then it's been super volatile, right? So as we look at the changing nature of policy with respect to current environment, so there's a lot of talk now of stimulating, you know, coal plants, for example, across Europe. And that changes the requirement of carbon, right? They're, you need to buy more, but then, you know, are the EU going to relax policy? So
yeah.
Then, you know, prices fall. So it's been super, super, super volatile. And then having moved away from the EU instrument and now having our own, it's kind of even more illiquid because there's less market actors that need to buy it, because we're not looking at the whole of Europe. We're just looking at only UK participants as well.
So surprise, surprise, the more fossil fuels you burn, the more carbon you need, and there's a fixed supply. So I guess, am I right in thinking that if the carbon price is going up, we're probably going to currently or in the near future be burning more fossil fuels because there's more requirement to cover the position or the emissions?
Yeah, that could be a reason.
So carbon price going up doesn't necessarily mean that probably means bad, right? It means we're burning more stuff.
Or it could mean that there's an anticipation of changing policy.
So or
we could be increasing the targets, for example.
Cool. Makes sense. Yeah. I want to ask you one last question now. What's going to happen in the future? I mean, where's this market headed and the stuff that you do?
Yeah.
What are you excited about?
So what am I excited about? If we touch back on the guarantees of origin market, I think that's hugely exciting going forward. So we've just seen this year a paper from National Grid on hydrogen. So there's a hydrogen target, 10 gigs of low carbon hydrogen by 2030. And they put out a paper saying that guarantees of origin will be key to this transition. So looking at effectively stimulating that market, allowing people to claim hydrogen, whether through the grid or through the bus. So, we could get to a stage where people could say, well, actually, I'm taking this bus because it's a green bus versus this bus, which is not a bus. So that's hugely exciting, but also the potential for interoperability between the certificate scheme. So how do you claim that hydrogen is green hydrogen, right? There's different colors of hydrogen. I don't know if you've covered that on a podcast before, but
yeah. I know we haven't, but
you haven't? Okay.
We've got, we're fans of Michael Liebreich's ladder and been following that very closely. Yeah, so you've got the green, blue, gray.
Multiple colors, yeah. So green is mainly electrolysis, but from green sources. So how do you prove that what's gone into the electrolyzer is actually green? Well, maybe you can use a Rego, but you've got to make sure that Rego can't then be used going forward as you get double counting. And then what happens to that hydrogen? Do you then go into transport? You need to transfer that into some transport certificates, or do you put it back into the grid? So you need to then cancel the hydrogen certificate and put it back into, Rego, for example. So that's the interoperability between different energy sources is going to be hugely exciting, I think.
And the exchange rate that we settle on, and the proof of exchange rate, because it's kind of like storage. It's
exactly the same.
This is cool.
But then also, if people are going to want to move to hourly matching on the certificate scheme, then there will be an hourly price for the Regos, and that'll be another market that batteries, for example, can participate in, because it's an additional revenue stream to consider, right? Because that corporate wants 100% renewable, and you need to be able to make that happen.
Very cool and very complicated.
Yeah,
we've got a lot of work to do. I just want to officially thanks for coming on.
No, thanks very much.
And it's been awesome having a chat. We've talked about a lot here today.
Yeah.
I guess there's a couple of things we've mentioned that we'll link to in the comments. And anybody who is listening to this, let us know what you think. And do hit that subscribe button. It means a lot to us. All right. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.